Up, up in his high, faraway confinement, the Crimson King feels a deep pain in his gut and drops into a chair, grimacing. Something, he knows, something fundamental, has changed in his dreary fiefdom. In the wake of the Queen Bee, Tyler Marshall, his eyes alight and his face without fear, sits astride Jack's shoulders like a boy king. Behind Jack and his friends, hundreds upon hundreds of children who are fleeing from the disintegrating structure of the big combination come streaming into Conger Road and the desolate fields beside it. Some of these children are from our world. Many are not. Children move across the dark, empty plains in ragged armies, advancing toward the entrances to their own universes. Limping battalions of children stagger off like columns of drunken ants. The children following the Sawyer Gang are no less ragged than the rest. Half of them are naked or as good as naked. These children have faces we have seen on milk cartons and flyers headed missing and on child find websites, faces from the dreams of heartbroken mothers and desolate fathers. Some of them are laughing, some are weeping, some are doing both. The stronger ones help the weaker ones along. They do not know where they are going, and they do not care. That they are going is enough for them. All they know is that they are free. The great machine that had stolen their strength and their joy and their hope is behind them, and a silken, protective canopy of bees is above them, and they are free. At exactly 4:16 p.m., the Sawyer Gang steps out through the front door of Black House. Tyler is now riding on Beezer's burly shoulders. They descend the steps and stand in front of Dale Gilbertson's cruiser. There's a litter of dead bees on the hood and in the well where the windshield wipers hide. "Look at the house, Hollywood," Doc murmurs. Jack does. It's only a house now. A three-story job that might once have been a respectable ranch, but has fallen into disrepair over the years. To make matters worse, someone has slopped it with black paint from top to bottom and stem to stern. Even the windows have been blurred with swipes of that paint. The overall effect is sad and eccentric, but by no means sinister. The house's slippery, shifting shape has solidified, and with the Abala's glamour departed, what remains is only the abandoned home of an old fellow who was pretty crazy and extremely dangerous. An old fellow to put beside such human monsters as Dahmer, Harmon, and Albert Fish. The leering, rampant evil that once inhabited this building has been dissipated, blown away, and what remains is as mundane as an old man mumbling in a cell on death row. There is something Jack must do to this wretched place, something the dying mouse made him promise to do. "Doc," Beezer says, "look yonder." A large dog, large but not monstrous, staggers slowly down the lane that leads back to Route 35. It looks like a cross between a boxer and a Great Dane. The side of its head and one of its rear paws have been blown away. "It's your devil dog," the bee says. Doc gapes. "What, that?" "That," Beezer confirms. He draws his 9mm, meaning to put the thing out of its misery, but before he can, it collapses on its side, takes a single deep shuddering breath, and then lies still. Beezer turns to Jack and Dale. "It's all a lot smaller with the machine turned off, isn't it?"
"I want to see my mother," Ty says quietly. "Please, may I?"
"Yes," Jack says. "Do you mind swinging by your house and picking up your father? I think he might like to go, too." Tyler breaks into a tired grin.
"Yes," he says. "Let's do that."
"You got it," Jack tells him. Dale swings the car carefully around the yard and has reached the beginning of the lane when Ty calls out,
"Look! Look, you guys! Here they come!"
Dale stops, peers in the rearview mirror,
and whispers, "Oh, Jack, Holy Mother of God." He puts the cruiser in park and gets out. They all get out, looking back at Black House. Its shape remains ordinary, but it has not quite given up all of its magic after all, it seems. Somewhere a door, perhaps in the cellar, or a bedroom, or a dirty and neglected but otherwise perfectly ordinary kitchen, remains open. On this side is the Coolie Country. On the other is Conger Road, the smoking, newly stopped hulk of the big combination, and the Din Ta. Bees are coming out onto the porch of Black House. Bees and the children the bees are leading. They come in droves, laughing and crying and holding hands. Jack Sawyer has a brief, brilliant image of animals leaving Noah's Ark after the flood. "Holy Mary, Mother of God," Dale whispers again. The yard is filling with laughing, crying, murmuring children. Jack walks up to Beezer, who turns to him with a brilliant smile. "After all the children come through, we have to close the door," Jack says. "For good." "I know we do," says Beezer. "You happen to have any brilliant ideas?" "Well," Beezer says, "let me put it this way. If you promise me, and I mean promise me, not to ask any awkward questions or say anything about it later, before midnight tonight, I might find it possible to lay my hands on a substantial quantity of something pretty damn effective."
"What, dynamite?"
"Please," Beezer says. "Didn't I say effective?"
"You mean..." Beezer smiles, and his eyes become slits. "I'm glad you're on my side," Jack says. "See you back on the road before midnight. We'll have to sneak in, but I don't think we'll have any trouble."
"Sure won't have any on the way out," Beezer says. Doc claps Dale on the shoulder. "I hope you've got some on-the-ball child welfare organizations in this part of the world, Chiefy. I think you're going to need them."
"Holy..." Dale turns stricken eyes to Jack. "What am I going to do?"
Jack grins. "I think you better make a call to... what does Sarah call them? The Color Posse?"
A gleam of hope dawns in Dale Gilbertson's eyes. Or maybe it's incipient triumph. John P. Redding of the FBI, officers Perry Brown and Jeffrey Black of the Wisconsin State Police. He imagines this trio of bungholes faced with the appearance of a medieval children's crusade in western Wisconsin. Imagines the Dickensian piles of paperwork such an unheard-of event must certainly generate. It will keep them occupied for months or years. It may generate nervous breakdowns. Certainly, it will give them something to think about other than Chief Dale Gilbertson of French Landing.
"Jack," he says, "what exactly do you suggest?"
"In broad strokes," Jack says, "I suggest that they should get stuck with all the work and you should hog all the credit. How does that sound to you?"
Dale thinks about it.
"Very fair," he says. "What do you say we get this kiddo to his dad, then both of them up to Arden to see his mom?"
"Good," Jack says. "I only wish Henry was here, too."
"That makes us a pair," Dale says, and slides back behind the wheel. A moment later, they are rolling up the lane.
"What about all those kids?" Ty asks, looking out through the back window. "Are you just going to leave them?"
"I'll call WSP as soon as we're back on the highway," Dale says. "I think they should get on this right away, don't you guys? And the Phoebes, of course."
"Right," Beezer says.
"Fucking A," Doc says.
"An excellent administrative call," Jack says, and sits Tyler down on his lap. "In the meantime, they'll be fine," he says in the boy's ear. "They've seen a lot worse than Wisconsin." Let us slip now from the driver's side window like the breeze we are, and watch them go, four brave men and one brave child, who will never be so young or so innocent again. Behind them, the now harmless and unmagicked yard of Black House
is alive with children, their faces dirty, their eyes wide with wonder. English is a minority tongue here, and some of the languages being spoken will puzzle the world's best linguists in the years ahead. This is the beginning of a worldwide sensation. Time's cover story the following week will be The Miracle Children from Nowhere. And as Dale has already surmised, a bureaucratic nightmare. Still, they are safe. And our guys are safe, too. All of them came back in one piece from the other side, and surely we did not expect that. Most quests of this type usually demand at least one sacrifice, a relatively minor character like Doc, for instance. All's well that ends well. And this can be the end, if you want it to be. Neither of the scribbling fellows who have brought you this far would deny you that. If you do choose to go on, never say you weren't warned. You're not going to like what happens next. Drudge Report. French Landing PD chief refuses to cancel press conference. Cite support of town officials. Sources confirm celeb LA cop will attend. FBI WISC SP express strong disapproval. Exclusive. One of them, Tyler Marshall, is from French Landing itself. Another, Josella Rakeen, is from Baiting, a small village in the south of England. A third is from Baghdad. All told, 17 of the so-called miracle children have been identified in the week since they were discovered walking along a rural highway, Route 35, in western Wisconsin. Yet these 17 are only the tip of the iceberg. Sources close to the joint FBI, WSP, and now CIA investigation tell the Drudge Report that there are at least 750 children, far more than have been reported in the mainstream press. Who are they? Who took them and to where? How did they get to the town of French Landing, which has been plagued by a serial killer, now reported deceased, in recent weeks? What part was played by Jack Sawyer, the Los Angeles detective who rose to stardom only to retire at age 31? And who was responsible for the massive explosion that destroyed a mysterious dwelling in the woods, reputedly central to the fisherman case? Some of these questions may be answered tomorrow in French Landing's La Follette Park when PD Chief Dale Gilbertson holds a press conference. His longtime friend Jack Sawyer, reputed to have broken the fisherman case single-handedly, will be standing next to him when he takes the podium. Also expected to be present are two deputies, Armand St. Pierre and Reginald Amberson, who participated in last week's rescue mission. The press conference will take place over the strong, almost strident objections of an FBI WSP task force headed by FBI agent John P. Redding and Wisconsin State Police Detective Jeffrey Black. They, task force leaders, believe this is nothing but a last-ditch effort on the part of Gilbertson to save his job, a source said. He botched everything, but luckily has a friend who knows a lot about public relations. French Landing town officials sing a different tune. This summer has been a nightmare for the people of French Landing, says town treasurer Beth Warren. Chief Gilbertson wants to assure the people that the nightmare is over. If he can give us some answers about the children in the process of doing that, so much the better. Interest focuses on Jack Hollywood Sawyer, who got to know Chief Gilbertson and the town of French Landing during the case of Thornburg Kinderling, the so-called prostitute killer. Sawyer was urged by Gilbertson to take an active role in the fisherman case and apparently played a large part in the events that followed. What events exactly were they? That is what the world is waiting to find out. The first answers may come tomorrow in La Follette Park on the banks of the mighty Mississippi. Developing... Chapter 29. You guys ready? Dale asks. Aw, man, I don't know, Doc says. This isn't the fifth time he's said it, maybe not even the 15th. He's pale, almost hyperventilating. The four of them are in a Winnebago, kind of a rolling green room, that has been set up on the edge of La Follette Park. Nearby is the podium on which they'll stand, always assuming Doc can keep his legs under him, and deliver their carefully crafted answers. On the slope running down to the broad river are gathered nearly 400 news people, plus camera crews from six American networks, and God knows how many foreign stations. The gentlemen of the press aren't in the world's best mood, because the prime space in front of the podium
has been reserved for a representative sampling drawn by lottery of French Landing's residents. This was Dale's one ironclad demand for the press conference. The idea for the press conference itself came from Jack Sawyer.
"Mellow out, Doc," Beezer says.
He looks bigger than ever in his gray linen slacks and open-collared white shirt, almost like a bear in a tuxedo. He has even made an effort to comb his acres of hair.
"And if you really think you're going to do one of the three P's, piss, puke, or pass out, stay here."
"Nah," Doc says miserably. "In for a penny, in for a fucking pound. If we're going to give it a try, let's give it a try." Dale, resplendent in his dress uniform, looks at Jack. The latter is, if anything, more resplendent in his gray summer weight suit and dark blue silk tie. A matching blue handkerchief pokes from the breast pocket of his coat.
"You sure this is the right thing?"
Jack is completely sure. It's not a matter of refusing to allow Sarah Gilbertson's color posse to steal the limelight. It's a matter of making certain that his old friend is in an unassailable position. He can do this by telling a very simple story, which the three other men will back up. Ty will do the same, Jack is confident. The story is this. Jack's other old friend, the late Henry Layden, figured out the fisherman's identity from the 911 tape. This tape was supplied by Dale, his nephew. The fisherman killed Henry, but not before the heroic Mr. Layden had mortally wounded him and passed his name to the police. Jack's other interest in this press conference, understood perfectly and supported completely by Dale, is to make sure Henry gets the credit he deserves. An examination of French Landing property records and plats uncovered the fact that Charles Burnside owned a house on Route 35, not far out of town. Dale deputized Jack and two wide bodies, who just happened to be in the vicinity, that would be Messrs. Amberson and St. Pierre, and they went on out there. From that point on, Jack told his friends repeatedly in the days leading up to the press conference, it's vital that you remember the three little words that lead to most acquittals in criminal trials. And what are those words?
I can't remember, Dale said.
Jack nodded. Right. If you don't have a story to remember, the bastards can never trip you up. There was something in the air inside that place.
No lie, Beezer rumbled and grimaced.
And it messed us up. What we do remember is this. Ty Marshall was in the backyard, handcuffed to the clothesline whirligig. Before Beezer St. Pierre and Jack Sawyer slipped through the police barricades and vaporized Black House with plastic explosive, one reporter got out there and took numerous pictures. We know which reporter it was, of course. Wendell Green has finally realized his dreams of fame and fortune.
And Burnside was dead at his feet, Beezer said.
Right, with the key to the handcuffs in his pocket. Dale, you found that and released the boy. There were a few other kids in the backyard, but as to how many...
We don't remember, Doc said.
As to their sexes,
a few boys, a few girls, Dale said. We don't remember exactly how many of each.
And as for Ty, how he was taken, what happened to him?
He said he didn't remember, Dale said, smiling.
We left. We think we called to the other kids, but don't exactly remember, the bees chips in. Right. And in any case, they seemed safe enough where they were for the time being. It was when we were putting Ty into the cruiser that we saw them all streaming out.
And call the Wisconsin State Police for backup, Dale said. I do remember that.
Of course you do, Jack said benevolently.
But we have no idea how that darn place got blasted all to hell, and we don't know who did it.
Some people, Jack said, are all too eager to take justice into their own hands.
Lucky they didn't blow their heads clean off, said Dale.
All right, Jack tells them now. They're standing at the door. Doc has produced half a joint, and four quick, deep tokes have calmed him visibly. Just remember why we're doing this. The message is that we were there first, we found Ty, we saw only a few other children, We deem their situation secure due to the death of Charles Burnside, also known as Carl Beerstone, the Southside Monster, and the Fisherman. The message is that Dale behaved properly, that we all did, and he then handed the investigation off to the FBI and WSP, who are now holding the baby. Babies, I guess, in this case. The message is that French Landing is okay again. Last, but far from least, the message is that Henry Layden's the real star. The heroic blind man who ID'd Charles Burnside and broke the fisherman case, mortally wounding the monster and losing his own life in the process. Amen, Dale says. Sweet old Uncle Henry. Beyond the door of the Winnebago, he can hear the surf-like rumble of hundreds of people, maybe even 1,000. He thinks, this is what rock acts hear before they hit the stage. A lump suddenly rises in his throat, and he does his best to gulp it back down. He reckons that if he keeps thinking of Uncle Henry, he will be okay. Anything else, Jack says. Questions that get too specific. We can't remember, Beezer says. Because the air was bad, Doc agrees. Smelled like ether or chloro or something like that. Jack surveys them, nods, smiles. This will be a happy occasion, on the whole, he thinks. A love feast. Certainly the idea that he might be dying in a few minutes has not occurred to him. Okay, he says. Let's go out there and do it. We're politicians this afternoon, politicians at a press conference. And it's the politicians who stay on message who get elected. He opens the RV's door. The rumble of the crowd deepens in anticipation. They cross to the jury-rigged platform this way, Beezer, Dale, Jack, and the good doctor. They move in a warm, white Nova glare of exploding flashbulbs and 10K TV lights. Jack has no idea why they need such things. The day is bright and warm, a coolie country charmer. But it seems they do, that they always do. Voices cry, over here, repeatedly. There are also thrown questions, which they ignore. When it comes time to answer questions, they will, as best they can. But for now, they are simply stunned by the crowd. The noise begins with the 200 or so French Landing residents sitting on folding chairs in a roped-off area directly in front of the podium. They rise to their feet, some clapping, others waving clenched fists in the air like winning boxers. The press picks it up from them, and as our four friends mount the steps to the podium, the roar becomes a thunder. We are with them, up on the platform with them. And God, we see so many faces we know looking up at us. There's Morris Rosen, who slipped Henry the Dirty Sperm CD on our first day in town. Behind him is a contingent from the now defunct Maxton Elder Care. The lovely Alice Weathers is surrounded by Elmer Jesperson, Ada Meyerhoff in a wheelchair, Flora Flostad, and the Betcher brothers, Hermie and Tom Tom. Tansy Freneau, looking a bit spaced out but no longer outright insane, is standing next to Lester Moon, who has his arm around her. Arnold Flashlight Hrabowski, Tom Lund, Bobby Dulac, and the other members of Dale's department are up on their feet, dancing around and cheering crazily. Look over there. That's Enid Purvis, the neighbor who called Fred at work on the day Judy finally high-sided it. There's Rebecca Vilas, looking almost nunnish in a high-collared dress, but cry no tears for her, Argentina. Becky has stashed away quite a nice bundle, thank you very much. Butch Yerxa is with her. At the back of the crowd, lurking shamefully but unable to stay away from the triumph of their friends, are William Strassner and Hubert Cantanero, better known to us as Kaiser Bill and Sonny. Look there, Herb Roper, who cuts Jack's hair, standing beside Buck Evitz, who delivers his mail. So many others we know, and to whom we must say goodbye under less than happy circumstances. In the front row, Wendell Green is hopping around like a hen on a hot griddle. God knows how he got into the roped-off area, being from La Riviere instead of French Landing, but he's there, taking pictures. Twice, he bumps into Elvina Morton, Henry's housekeeper. The third time he does it, she bats him a damn good one on top of the head. Wendell hardly seems to notice. His head has taken worse shots during the course of the fisherman investigation. And off to one side, we see someone else we may or may not recognize. An elderly, dark-skinned gentleman wearing shades. He looks a little bit like an old blues singer. He also looks a little bit like a movie actor named Woody Strode. The applause thunders and thunders. Folks cheer. Hats are thrown in the air and sail on the summer breeze. Their welcome becomes a kind of miracle in itself, an affirmation, perhaps even an acceptance, of the children, who are widely supposed to have been held in some bizarre sexual bondage linked to the Internet. Isn't all that weird stuff somehow linked to the Internet? And, of course, they applaud because the nightmare is over. The boogeyman died in his own backyard, died at the foot of a prosaic, now vaporized, aluminum clothes-whirly gig, and they are safe again. Oh, how the cheers ring in these few last moments of Jack Sawyer's life on planet Earth. Birds are startled up from the bank of the river and go squawking and veering into the sky, seeking quieter environs. On the river itself, a freighter responds to the cheers, or perhaps joins in, by blasting its air horn over and over. Other boats get the idea and add to the cacophony. Without thinking about what he's doing, Jack takes Doc's right hand in his left, Dale's left hand in his right. Dale takes Beezer's hand, and the Sawyer gang raises their arms together, facing the crowd. Which, of course, goes nuts. If not for what is going to happen next, it would be the picture of the decade, perhaps of the century. They stand there in triumph, living symbols of victory with their linked hands in the sky, the crowd cheering, the video cams rolling, the Nikons flashing. And that is when the woman in the third row begins to make her move. This is someone else we know, but it takes us a second or two to recognize her, because she has had nothing at all to do with the case we have been following. She's just been sort of lurking around. The 200 seats up front have been awarded by random drawing from the French Landing voter rolls. The lucky lottery winners notified by Debbie Anderson, Pam Stevens, and Dit Jesperson. This woman was number 199. Several people shrink from her as she passes them, although in their happy frenzy, they are hardly aware of doing it. This pale woman with clumps of straw-colored hair sticking to her cheeks smells of sweat and sleeplessness and vodka. She's got a little purse. The little purse is open. She's reaching into it. And we who have lived through the second half of the 20th century and have, through the miracle of TV, witnessed a dozen assassinations and near assassinations, know exactly what she is reaching for. We want to scream a warning to the four men standing with their linked hands raised to the sky, but all we can do is watch. Only the black man with the sunglasses sees what's happening. He turns and starts to move, aware that she has probably beaten him, that he is probably going to be too late. No, Speedy Parker thinks. It can't end like this. It can't. Jack, get down, he shouts. But no one hears him over the clapping, the cheering, the wild hurrahs. The crowd seems to block him on purpose, surging back and forth in front of him no matter which way he moves. For a moment, Wendell Green, still bobbing around like a man in the throes of an epileptic seizure, is in the assassin's path. Then she heaves him aside with the strength of a madwoman. Why not? She is a madwoman. Folks, Dale's got his mouth practically on the microphone, and the PA horns mounted to the nearby trees whine with feedback. He's still holding up Jack's hand on his left and Beezer's on his right. There's a small, dazed smile on his face. Thank you, folks. We sure do appreciate the support. But if you could just quiet down. That's when Jack sees her. It's been a long time, years, but he recognizes her at once. He should. She spat in his face one day as he left the Los Angeles courthouse. Spat at him and called him a railroading bastard. She's lost 50 pounds since then, Jack thinks. Maybe more. Then he sees the hand in the purse, and even before it comes back out, he knows what's happening here. The worst is that he can do nothing about it. Doc and Dale have his hands in a death grip. He drags in a deep breath and shouts, as he has been taught to in just such a situation as this, "Gun!" And Dale Gilbertson nods as if to say, "Yes, it is. It is fun." Behind her, pushing through the clapping, cheering crowd, he sees Speedy Parker. But unless Speedy's got a particularly good magic trick up his sleeve, he doesn't. Speedy Parker, known in the territories as Parkus, is just fighting his way into the aisle when the woman standing below the platform brings out her gun. It's an ugly little thing, a Bulldog 32 with its handle wrapped in black kitchen tape, and Jack has just half a second to think that maybe it will blow up in her hand. "Gun!" Jack shouts again. And it's Doc Amberson who hears him and sees the snarling woman crouched just below them. "Oh, fuck," Doc says. "Wanda, no!" Jack cries. Doc has let go of his left hand, Dale has still got his right one hoisted high in the summer air, and Jack holds it out to her like a traffic cop. Wanda Kinderling's first bullet goes right through the palm, mushrooms slightly, begins to tumble, and punches into the hollow of Jack's left shoulder. Wanda speaks to him. There's too much noise for Jack to hear her, but he knows what she's saying just the same. "Here you go, you railroading son of a bitch." Thorny says hello. She empties the remaining 5 bullets into Jack Sawyer's chest and throat. No one hears the insignificant popping sounds made by Wanda's Bulldog 32, not over all that clapping and cheering. But Wendell Green has got his camera tilted up, and when the detective jerks backward, our favorite reporter's finger punches the Nikon shutter release button in simple reflex. It snaps off 8 shots. The third is the picture. The one that will eventually become as well known as the photo of the Marines raising the flag on Iwo Jima and that of Lee Harvey Oswald clutching his belly in the parking garage of the Dallas police station. In Wendell's photo, Jack Sawyer looks calmly down toward the shooter, who is just a blur at the very bottom of the frame. The expression on his face might be one of forgiveness. Daylight is clearly visible through the hole in the palm of his outstretched hand. Droplets of blood, as red as rubies, hang frozen in the air beside his throat, which has been torn open. The cheering and the applause stop as if amputated. There is a moment of awful, uncomprehending silence. Jack Sawyer, shot twice in the lungs and once in the heart, as well as in the hand and the throat, stands where he is, gazing at the hole below his spread fingers and above his wrist. Wanda Kinderling peers up at him with her dingy teeth bared. Speedy Parker is looking at Jack with an expression of naked horror that his wraparound sunglasses cannot conceal. To his left, up on one of 4 media towers surrounding the platform, a young cameraman faints and falls to the ground. Then, suddenly, the freeze frame that Wendell has captured without even knowing it bursts open, and everything is in motion. Wanda Kinderling screams, "See you in hell, Hollywood!" Several people will later verify this, and then puts the muzzle of her 32 to her temple. Her look of vicious satisfaction gives way to a more typical one of dazed incomprehension, when the twitch of her finger produces nothing but a dry click. The Bulldog 32 is empty. A moment later, she is pretty much obliterated, broken neck, broken left shoulder, 4 broken ribs, as Doc stage dives onto her and drives her to the ground. His left shoe strikes the side of Wendell Green's head, but this time Wendell sustains no more than a bloody ear. Well, he was due to catch a break, wasn't he? On the platform, Jack Sawyer looks unbelievingly at Dale, tries to speak, and cannot. He staggers, remains upright a moment longer, then collapses. Dale's face has gone from bemused delight to utter shock and dismay in a heartbeat. He seizes the microphone and screams, "He's shot! We need a doctor!" The PA horns shriek with more feedback. No doctor comes forward. Many in the crowd panic and begin to run. The panic spreads. Beezer is down on one knee, turning Jack over. Jack looks up at him, still trying to speak. Blood pours from the corners of his mouth. "Ah, oh, fuck! It's bad, Dale! It's really bad!" Beezer cries, and then he is knocked sprawling. One wouldn't expect that the scrawny old black man who's vaulted up onto the stage could knock around a bruiser like Beezer, but this is no ordinary old man, as we well know. There is a thin but perfectly visible envelope of white light surrounding him. Beezer sees it. His eyes widen. The crowd, meanwhile, flees to the four points of the compass. Panic infects some of the ladies and gentlemen of the press as well. Not Wendell Green. He holds his ground like a hero, snapping pictures until his Nikon is as empty as Wanda Kinderling's gun. He snaps the black man as he stands with Jack Sawyer in his arms, snaps Dale Gilbertson putting a hand on the black man's shoulder, snaps the black man turning and speaking to Dale. When Wendell later asks French Landing's chief of police what the old fellow said, Dale tells him he doesn't remember. Besides, in all that pandemonium, he could hardly make it out anyway. All bullshit, of course, but we may be sure that if Jack Sawyer had heard Dale's response, he would have been proud. When in doubt, tell him you can't remember. Wendell's last picture shows Dale and Beezer watching with identical dazed expressions as the old fellow mounts the steps to the Winnebago with Jack Sawyer still in his arms. Wendell has no idea how such an old party can carry such a big man. Sawyer is 6'2" and must go 190 at least. But he supposes it's the same sort of deal that allows a distraught mother to lift up the car or truck beneath which her kid is pinned. And it doesn't matter. It's small beans compared to what happens next. Because when a group of men led by Dale, Bees, and Doc burst into the Winnebago, Wendell is at the rear of this group, they find nothing but a single overturned chair and several splashes of Jack Sawyer's blood in the kitchenette where Jack gave his little gang their final instructions. The trail of blood leads toward the rear, where there's a fold-out bed and a toilet cubicle. And there the drops and splashes simply stop. Jack and the old man who carried him in here have vanished. Doc and Beezer are babbling, almost in hysterics. They bounce between questions of where Jack might have gone to distraught recollections of the final few moments on the platform before the shooting started. They can't seem to let that go, and Dale has an idea it will be quite a while before he can let go of it himself. He realizes now that Jack saw the woman coming, that he was trying to get his hand free of Dale's so he could respond. Dale thinks it may be time to quit the chief's job after all, find some other line of work. Not right now, though. Right now, he wants to get Beezer and Doc away from the color posse, get them calmed down. He has something to tell them that may help with that. Tom Lund and Bobby Dulac join him, and the three of them escort Bees and Doc away from the Winnebago, where Special Agent Redding and WSP Detective Black are already establishing a CIP, Crime Investigation Perimeter. Once they're behind the platform, Dale looks into the stunned faces of the two burly bikers. "Listen to me," Dale says. "I should have stepped in front of him," Doc says. "I saw her coming. Why didn't I step in front? Shut up and listen." Doc shuts up. Tom and Bobby are also listening, their eyes wide. "That black man said something to me." "What?" Beezer asks. "He said, let me take him, there may still be a chance." Doc, who has treated his share of gunshot wounds, gives a forlorn little chuckle. "And you believed him?" "Not then, not exactly," Dale says. "But when we went in there, and the place was empty..." "No back door either," Beezer adds.
Doc's skepticism has faded a little. You really think?
I do, Dale Gilbertson says, and wipes his eyes. I have to hope, and you guys have to help me.
All right, Beezer says. Then we will.
And we think that here we must leave them for good, standing under a blue summer sky close to the Father of Waters, standing beside a platform with blood on the boards. Soon life will catch them up again and pull them back into its furious current. But for a few moments they are together, joined in hope for our mutual friend. Let us leave them so, shall we? Let us leave them, hoping.
Once upon a time in the territories. Once upon a time, as all the best old stories used to begin when we all lived in the forest and nobody lived anywhere else, a scarred captain of the Outer Guards named Farron led a frightened little boy named Jack Sawyer through the Queen's Pavilion. That small boy did not see the Queen's Court, however. No, he was taken through a maze of corridors behind the scenes, secret and seldom visited places where spiders spun in the high corners and the warm drafts were heavy with the smells of cooking from the kitchen. Finally, Farron placed his hands in the boy's armpits and lifted him up. "There's a panel in front of you now," he whispered. "Do you remember? I think you were there. I think we both were. Although we were younger then, weren't we? Slide it to the left." Jack did as he was bidden, and found himself peeking into the Queen's chamber, the room in which almost everyone expected her to die, just as Jack expected his mother to die in her room at the Alhambra Inn and Gardens in New Hampshire. It was a bright, airy room filled with bustling nurses who had assumed a busy and purposeful manner because they had no real idea of how to help their patient. The boy looked through the peephole into this room at a woman he at first thought was his own mother, somehow magically transported to this place. And we looked with him, none of us guessing that years later, grown to a man, Jack Sawyer would be lying in the same bed where he first saw his mother's twinner. Parkus, who has brought him from French Landing to the inner baronies, now stands at the panel through which Jack, hoisted by Captain Farron, once looked. Beside him is Sophie of Canna, now known in the territories as both the Young Queen and Sophie the Good. There are no nurses in the sleeping chamber today. Jack lies silent beneath a slowly turning fan. Where he is not wrapped in bandages, his skin is pale. His closed eyelids are hazed with a delicate purple bruise blush. The rise and fall of the fine linen sheet drawn up to his chin can hardly be seen. But it's there. He breathes. For now, at least, he lives. Speaking quietly, Sophie says, "If he'd never touched the talisman, if he'd never touched the talisman, actually held it in his arms, he would have been dead there on that platform before I could even get close to him," Parkus says. "But of course, if not for the talisman, he never would have been there in the first place." "What chance has he?" She looks at him. Somewhere in another world, Judy Marshall has already begun to subside back into her ordinary suburban life. There will be no such life for her twinner, however. Hard times have come again in this part of the universe, and her eyes gleam with an imperious, regal light. "Tell me the truth, sir. I would not have a lie. Nor would I give you one, my lady," he tells her. "I believe
that thanks to the residual protection of the talisman, he will recover. You'll be sitting next to him one morning or evening, and his eyes will open. Not today, and probably not this week, but soon. And as for returning to his world, the world of his friends, Parcus has brought her to this place because the spirit of the boy Jack was still lingers, ghostly and child-sweet. He was here before the road of trials opened ahead of him, and in some ways hardened him. He was here with his innocence still intact. What has surprised him about Jack as a grown man, and touched him in a way Parcus never expected to be touched again, is how much of that innocence still remained in the man the boy has become. That, too, is the talisman's doing, of course. Parcus, your mind wanders. Not far, my lady, not far. You ask if he may return to his world after being mortally wounded 3, perhaps even 4 times, after being heart-pierced, in fact. I brought him here because all the magic that has touched and changed his life is stronger here. For good or ill, the territories have been Jack Sawyer's wellspring since he was a child. And it worked. He lives. But he will wake different. He'll be like... Parcus pauses, thinking hard. Sophie waits quietly beside him. Distantly from the kitchen comes the bellow of a cook lacing into one of the prentices. There are animals that live in the sea, breathing with gills, Parcus says at last. And over time's long course, some of them develop lungs. Such creatures can live both under the water and on the land. Yes? So I was taught as a girl, Sophie agrees patiently. But some of these latter creatures lose their gills and can live only on the land. Jack Sawyer is that sort of creature now, I think. You or I could dive into the water and swim beneath the surface for a little while, and he may be able to go back and visit his own world for short periods, in time, of course. But if either you or I were to try living beneath the water, we'd drown. Indeed, we would. And if Jack were to try living in his own world again, returning to his little house in Norway Valley, for instance, his wounds would return in a space of days or weeks, perhaps in different forms. His death certificate might specify heart failure, for instance. But it would be Wanda Kindling's bullet that killed him all the same. Wanda Kindling's heart shot. Parcus bares his teeth. Hateful woman. I believe the Abala was aware of her no more than I was. But look at the damage she's caused. Sophie ignores this. She is looking at the silent, sleeping man in the other room. Condemned to live in such a pleasant land as this, to his arms, and she goes willingly, her face pressed against his chest. In the dark, behind the chamber in which Jack Sawyer sleeps, Parcus answers her question with a single word. Kaa. Epilogue. She sits by his bed, on the first night of full Earth Moon, 10 days after her conversation with Parcus in the secret passageway. Outside the pavilion, she can hear children singing the Green Corn Adeo. On her lap is a scrap of embroidery. It is summer, still summer, and the air is sweet with summer's mystery. And in this billowing room where his mother's twinner once lay, Jack Sawyer opens his eyes. Sophie lays aside her embroidery, leans forward, and puts her lips, soft
against the shell of his ear. "Welcome back," she says. "My heart, my life, and my love. Welcome back."
April 14, 2001.
This is Frank Muller. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Black House by Stephen King and Peter Straub. This program was produced by David Rapkin, directed by John Behan, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2001 by Rigatoni. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.